Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, May 8, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group telephone conference call. Today, we're going to be discussing cybersecurity, information sharing, privacy, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome to our program a panel of four experts. We're going to hear opening remarks from the first three experts, then some commentary and questions led by our fourth expert, and then questions from our audience. First up will be Mr. Gus Coldabella. He is a partner at the Goodwin Procter Law Firm here in Washington, D.C., and he's former acting general counsel at the Department of Homeland Security. Second, we'll hear from Michelle Richardson, who's legislative counsel at the ACLU in its Washington legislative office, where she focuses on national security and government transparency issues. She's former counsel at the House Judiciary Committee. We'll hear third from Professor Nathan Sales. He is a professor at the George Mason University School of Law. He's also a former Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security official. And then, as I mentioned, we'll hear some commentary and questions led by our fourth expert, Mr. John Reed. He is a writer in National Security and Other Matters for Foreign Policy magazine. And with that, Mr. Coldabella, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Thanks, Dean, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me, and thanks to my fellow panelists for participating in this discussion. Since I have the purely alphabetical distinction of kicking things off here, I'll begin by discussing some cybersecurity trends that affect the legal policy landscape, and then talk a bit about what we mean when we say information sharing, why we think it's a good thing, and why, if it's done the right way, it's actually protective of privacy rather than the other way around. I'll then talk a little bit about cybersecurity regulation and why, whether or not you think it's a necessary thing or a good idea, everyone has got to be paying attention to what the government is doing in this area. So I think the first point I'm going to make is a non-controversial one, which is the threat is real and it's growing. The reasons for this are clear. The internet itself was designed to be an open system. The only barrier to entry is access to a computer and the Wi-Fi signal at your local Starbucks. And you know what? Those are the only barriers to entry of being a hacker as well. The threat is growing. Why? The countries and the world's economy and commercial transactions are on the internet. Valuable IP is available there, intellectual property. For individuals, our bank accounts, our emails, our photos, even minute-by-minute location data from the GPS units in our phones. So we're dealing not only with the kid on his mom's computer at Starbucks, but nation-states, organized crime, hacktivists like Anonymous, with different purposes and methods, from extortion to theft to spying and stealing of IP and business secrets, all the way to affecting things in the physical world like power plants and dams and other critical infrastructure. So this is going to continue because this is where almost everything of value is. The second trend is the private sectors and more recently the government's willingness to identify, to call out nation states that are conducting these types of network operations. Just this week, DOD detailed China's capabilities in a report Mandiant did before, and there's wide speculation that Iran was responsible for the massive denial of service attacks against U.S. financial institutions over the last year. This puts the battle in a different light. It's no longer country versus country, it's country versus company. Now, the third trend that we're seeing, which is likely related to the second one, is the increasing willingness of companies to disclose cyber attacks when they find them. Think about Apple and Facebook over the past few months, especially when there's some effect on their customers, and even when they're not required to do so by law. Companies have seen predecessors who have been attacked get pilloried for not disclosing breaches or not disclosing them fast enough. They've also seen that the reaction of the public and of security professionals, which used to be akin to blame the guy who just got shot for not wearing a good enough vest, has been moving toward we're all in this together in a fight against a common enemy. And this trend leads to another trend, which is the private sector is reacting to the now, better known threat by investing in and creating new and better solutions to develop to defeat it. But is it enough? That brings us to the government role, and specifically to information sharing and why it's not happening and why some of us think that's the main impediment to shoring up cyber defenses. So what is information sharing? This is a lawyer's description and not an engineer's, but when a system is hacked, certain information is left behind. The malware itself, logs may reveal the methods the hacker used to infiltrate or the IP addresses that they used to hack in. There are other things. The idea behind information sharing is that the hackers are probably using the same method across the board, and networks that have information about what another attack looked like will be better able to guard against the same or similar attacks on their own networks. The private sector has information along these lines, and the government does too, both through law enforcement investigations and intel gathering. Each side knows a heck of a lot, but it's not frequently shared. The reason it's not frequently shared is that there are structural disincentives to doing so. On the private sector side, a company that's just been hacked doesn't want that to end up on the front page of the Washington Post, and they're disinclined to share it with an agency like DHS, for example, unless there are assurances that it's not going to be shared with their regulator, like the SEC, or ultimately be subject to a FOIA request. On the government side, the FBI doesn't want to share information that might tip off a bad guy, and intel agencies don't want to compromise sources and methods. So what's the solution here? It's a tough one, but it's to get actors to participate in a voluntary program. The government's role has got to be eliminating the disincentives and providing protections. A failure of how the administration has handled this problem so far has to not use the tools that it has already. The Homeland Security Act allows DHS to take in this kind of information and wrap it in the protections that I just described, but that tool hasn't yet been deployed in President Obama's executive order or elsewhere. Now, there are some other criticisms of information sharing, and with apologies to Michelle for characterizing her position, which I'm sure I will be corrected on in a minute, the ACLU has said, you know, we've got to balance privacy against security, and privacy demands that this type of information not be shared with the government, and that companies should be held liable if they include incidental personal information while information sharing. I have two reactions to this. First, there's already a privacy violation going on by the hackers. When somebody's identity is stolen or a bank account is raided, when some hacker gets access to your email or location data, and when some nation state finds out just who's working on a civil rights case against it. You know, just a few examples of the ill effects of not having a robust cyber defense. And second, remember, if the government is asking us not just to share, but do it the right way, and if you don't do it the right way, there's a cause of action against you, how many companies do you think will participate, and how valuable would the information be? The government already employs a process called minimization to eliminate personal information in the data it receives. That process should be baked into information sharing at the front end rather than stopping the entire program for attenuated privacy concerns. Now, last point. This is on the other side of the regulatory ledger. The president's recent executive order, which I mentioned, calls for voluntary cybersecurity standards, in quotes, to be set up, and for those standards to apply to owners of certain critical infrastructure. But these standards are voluntary, like paying your taxes is voluntary, or the draft is voluntary. In this context, voluntary means mandatory. And this is true for a few interrelated reasons. The executive order itself requires agencies to explore how to make them mandatory. Those private sector entities that are going to be subject to the regulation are going to do what I call trickle-down regulation, which is cause the entities that are in business relationships with them, their law firms, their banks, their other service providers, to live up to the same standards. Third, it's not unreasonable to think that as negligence suits arise around computer intrusions that plaintiff's lawyers and judges, or maybe defendant's lawyers, are going to start thinking that this standard promulgated by the government should be the standard of care. And there are other market and regulatory forces that cause this to happen. So it's beyond the scope of this call to debate whether or not you think that the regulation in this area is a good idea, or if the market can handle it itself, or the disconnect is really information sharing and not regulation in this area. But the bottom line that I want to make is that the standards that are being developed now are not likely to be voluntary, and they're not likely to just apply to critical infrastructure operators. So everyone in the private sector has got to pay attention. With that, I am very pleased to turn over the virtual mic to Michelle Richardson.
Great. Thank you very much. Happy to be here today, and you could find all of the ACLU's materials on cybersecurity at aclu.org/cybersecurity. So today we're talking about information sharing, and this is very timely because it's become a priority for both Congress and the administration, and there's much agreement in all of the branches that more information sharing is necessary to better protect against cyber attacks. However, that's where the agreement ends, and there is much debate about what that means. The idea is that under current privacy laws, companies are prevented from sharing some information that could be useful to identify or thwart a cyber attack. And you'll often hear references to ECPA and FISA, which govern how the government can obtain communications data, both records and contents. And it's not clear exactly how those laws are preventing information sharing right now. While those laws create a presumption of privacy, they have exceptions for emergency circumstances, for example, or for the defense of one's networks. We also know there are plenty of existing information sharing programs going on right now. Each sector has an information sharing council where members of the field come together and share information. The defense industrial base has long been working with the executive branch. People can always report crimes to the FBI, and people can always turn over information on their own networks to DHS or an agency that regulates them. In fact, current information sharing programs, even short of legislation, have been expanding over the last several years. For example, in the executive order signed by President Obama just this past February, a longstanding program was extended to all of critical infrastructure. So that's all 18 high-value targets are already engaged in information sharing with the executive branch, and that will be more fully deployed as time goes forward. However, if there is going to be legislation in this area, the question is, what should it look like? And there are a couple of key questions, because information sharing per se isn't bad. But the questions are, one, what can be shared? And it's absolutely crucial that if Congress writes a law that will get them outside of every privacy law ever written, that it very narrowly define what information can be shared. Now, you could do this in a tech-neutral way, in a way that will stand the test of time, by simply saying companies need to make reasonable efforts to pull out irrelevant, personally identifiable information before they share the rest of the data that's directly relevant to an actual threat signature. Second, you have to determine who will receive the information. It's certainly contemplated that there will be private-to-private information sharing, but if a company wants to go directly to the government, it's absolutely crucial that they be forced to go through a civilian agency. Some have proposed that companies have a free-for-all and can go to anyone they like, including military agencies like the NSA. However, the NSA is a massive spying operation that has been built up over the last half century because it was directed at foreigners and people overseas who are not protected by the Constitution. To set them loose in the bounds of the United States to collect this information on everyday Americans would be unprecedented, and pose an incredible threat to civil liberties. And the final question that you want to answer is, well, what can be done with the information once it's shared? It's incredibly important to say that the recipients, be it private companies or the government, are limited to using that information only for cybersecurity purposes. You don't want this to become a backdoor for the government to collect information for, let's say, totally unrelated criminal prosecutions. If in the information sharing process, something comes to them about immigration or taxes or guns or something like that, you do not want this to be another avenue for them to prosecute people or otherwise take actions. Now, there are two proposals, one in the House that recently passed, it's called CISPA, and a bill from last Congress in the Senate that is yet to be reintroduced. The former, the House bill, is a failure in many ways, especially in that it allows companies to work directly with the NSA, and it doesn't require companies to take even reasonable efforts to protect personal information. The Senate bill is more tailored, and the Senate bill is the one that has been endorsed by the administration, including the director of the NSA himself. Now, I would not say that we need to choose between privacy and security. I think you can have both. And that's what the Senate bill represents, at least its information sharing title. The NSA and other senior advisors with the administration have signed off on privacy protections and says that these programs will still be perfectly operational even if companies are forced to protect personal information or agencies are forced to go through DHS or another civilian agency. And so the idea that putting in these privacy protections would somehow slow the process or be too burdensome is just not true. The cybersecurity experts themselves say it's workable with these protections. So you really don't have to choose. I guess the one thing I will respond to is this idea of regulation. This has been treated as a separate area from information sharing. And in fact, there's really 10 different things going on in cybersecurity, and information sharing is really the only one that's controversial from a privacy or civil liberties standpoint. Things like setting standards for the industry are perfectly fine as far as civil liberties are concerned. Educating the public, because really, even the experts will tell you that 90% of cybersecurity problems are hygiene issues, and that if you teach people not to click on bad links and have strong passwords, most of these problems will be solved. We need to train a workforce for the future, because companies cannot fill cybersecurity slots fast enough. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of positions open every day for people with a tech background to work in this area. And you could also secure the supply chain to make sure that products we're buying overseas don't come here infected and spread in the United States. So there are a lot of different options here. You know, everybody is focused on information sharing, but there are other alternatives that are just as important and don't implicate civil liberties and privacy. And we hope that as Congress moves forward and the administration moves forward on this, that they really stick tight to some of these principles that have long been in privacy law. And with that, I will turn it over to Nathan.
All right. Thank you very much, Michelle. Thanks to the Federal Society for organizing this conference, virtual conference, and thanks to you all for listening in. I look forward to your questions later on. I'd like to talk a bit about cybersecurity regulation, what we mean by that, what types of regulation should be considered, and what types of regulation shouldn't be considered. The first question I want to look at is what's the need for a regulatory response to cybersecurity problems? Is the private sector currently making adequate investments in cyber defense, or do they need a bit of a nudge or maybe even a shove? The second thing I'll look at is if we do think that some form of cybersecurity regulation is appropriate, what should that look like? Traditional regulatory standards, civil liability regime, or several other alternatives. And if there's time, I'll weigh in on some of the information sharing questions that have been raised as well. So let me address that first problem. The question is whether private sector firms are making adequate levels of investment in defending their systems and networks against possible intruders. We can understand this problem in basic economic terms.
don't worry, we're on the phone, so I can't use equations anyway. I think there's a general sense that firms are not making adequate levels of investments, and part of the reason for that is because of what's called negative externalities. The basic idea is that if a firm suffers a cyber attack, it will be costly to the firm, but some of the costs that result, some of the social costs that result from the attack are borne by third parties with which the firm has no particular relationship. So, for instance, if there's a cyber intrusion upon a the power grid, and the power grid is taken down, obviously the power company is going to suffer. If it's not selling electricity, it's not getting paid. And some of the firm's customers are going to suffer as well, and then they can ask for reimbursement. But some third parties, some remote third parties, are also going to be injured by such a cyber attack. So in that situation, the firm that's deciding how much to invest in defending itself against possible intrusions, it's going to account for the cost that it will bear, and it's going to account for the costs that its customers will bear, but it's probably not going to take into account the harms that would result to remote and distant third parties. But put somewhat more succinctly, the level of investment in cyber defense for a particular firm may not be the same as the socially optimal level of investment for society overall. So if that's the case, what's the proper regulatory response? Well, one type of regulatory response that I think we shouldn't really take seriously in this context is traditional command and control regulation. So the EPA puts out rules governing clean air standards to internalize the externalities that result from pollution at coal-fired power plants. I don't think that model is well suited at all to the cybersecurity context for two basic reasons. One is the very long length of the regulatory cycle virtually ensures that by the time the government gets around to putting out a new regulatory set of standards, technology is going to have left it behind. Notice and comment rulemaking is not the most nimble form of policymaking, and it's not one that's well suited to a technologically dynamic field like cyber. Another problem has to do with information asymmetries between government regulators on the one hand and private sector experts on the other. The private sector entities like power plants, like telecommunications carriers, and so on, often are going to know an awful lot more about the vulnerabilities in their systems, the threats that their systems have experienced, than regulators are. And I think it would be imprudent to expect regulators to have an informational advantage necessary to promulgate security standards. Another reason, well, actually, let me, time's going to be short, so let me turn to another topic. So if not command and control regulation, what kind of regulation can we expect? Well, one type of regulation that we might look at is one that involves the private sector and asks the private sector to play a prominent role in determining the content of any cybersecurity standards, rather than leaving it to experts, I'm using air quotes that you can't see, at the NSA or DHS or elsewhere in the federal bureaucracy. Let's tap into the private sector expertise. They know more about threats. They know more about vulnerabilities. They know more about countermeasures than a typical cyber bureaucrat will. And there's a number of different variations that we could consider. Delegated regulation, in which the government establishes a number of goals and then leaves it up to the firms to decide how to meet those goals. Some form of negotiated rulemaking, in which private firms are actually at the decision-making table along with other interested stakeholders in the formulation of those standards. Those are alternatives that I think are able to tap into private sector expertise and don't require us to put too much faith in regulation, traditional command and control regulation by bureaucrats. Another possible response to cyber insecurity would involve tweaking the rules for civil liability. Now, right now, there's a fairly low risk that a firm that suffers a cyber intrusion and injures third parties as a result will have to face any form of civil liability. The reason for that is an old tort law doctrine known as the economic loss doctrine. The basic rule is if you commit a tort that causes only economic injury to a victim, you're generally not responsible to compensate the victim. If you cause physical injuries, then any economic harms that result from those physical injuries are compensable, but in general, you can't recover for purely economic losses. An interesting case that applies this doctrine in the cyber context comes out of Massachusetts from, I think, 2009, involved BJ's Wholesale Club, which was alleged to have used substandard cybersecurity practices in securing its customer data, you know, credit card numbers, names of customers, and so on. And perpetrators were able to access that information and cause a great deal of harm to individual consumers as well as to the banks and credit unions that issued those consumers their credit cards. The Massachusetts Supreme Judicial Court concluded that BJ's could not be held liable for its alleged negligent practices in a straightforward application of the economic loss doctrine. And I fear that in a number of cybersecurity contexts, we're going to see the same bar to recovery for those who are injured. Why does that matter? Well, if there's no threat of civil liability, that reduces the incentives of private firms to take adequate steps to safeguard customer information to secure their own networks. So how can we remedy that situation? I think a combination of carrots and sticks should be on the table. So the carrots would involve extending some form of liability protection or other immunity or other benefits to firms that agree to implement the shared security standards. So this would tie back into the regulatory response that we considered a minute ago. As for the sticks, well, firms that don't implement shared security standards might be held liable for the resulting harms that accrue to their customers or others in the event of a successful cyber attack. Basically, that would involve suspending the economic loss doctrine in the limited context of cybersecurity. I've said my piece, so let me stop here and turn things over to our next panelist, John Reed.
Okay, thank you everybody for being on the call today, my fellow panelists, the audience, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having us. I think everybody just framed the issue for today's conversation pretty well, so I'm going to jump into the questions. My first one really is, how big is the cyber threat? I mean, can private businesses defend themselves against attacks by nation states, by you know, the PLA coming at them? And or is it just being overblown at a time of declining budgets? People want to get a piece of the pie, so you're hearing the threat hyped.
Yeah, John, this is Nathan. Let me take a first swing at that question. It's a great question. And to frame the answer to the question, let's consider what it looks like in real space during traditional warfare. So in the ultimate question here is, who's responsible for defending private networks against attacks by very, very sophisticated foreign adversaries, such as foreign governments, intelligence services? Well, in World War II, we didn't really expect strategically significant factories to put up their own anti-aircraft batteries to defend against Luftwaffe bombers. And I don't think we should expect private firms to shoulder the burden of defending their critical infrastructure against highly skilled and determined adversaries like the Chinese government. If they did, they would basically be subsidizing security for the rest of us, providing a form of public good, which is inadvisable for a number of reasons. So to the extent that they are on the front lines, but to the extent that strategically significant firms are on the front lines of future cyber conflicts, there needs to be a partnership between them and the government involving cost sharing in which the government shoulders a significant portion of the responsibility for defending critical infrastructure against foreign governments.
John, it's Gus Coldabella. I'll weigh in very quickly. I mean, I think the dynamic here is that, you know, you have nation states who are developing very sophisticated tools to use against governments. And the governments eventually figure out that they're using these tools. When the governments discover that the tools are being used, the adversary doesn't just put it up on a shelf and say, oh, well, better luck next time. The tool is then used against private sector actors and others in the cyber marketplace. And this is what I meant by country versus company in my earlier remarks. I think something that Nathan was suggesting is that information sharing can help to alleviate this problem. If the government is the one who's got the big eye on this and is getting most of the attacks, the most sophisticated attacks, and is able to somehow push out a sanitized version of, hey guys, be on the lookout for this. That can help to bridge the gap that John, you identified in your question. One issue, and this goes to the regulatory push and pull that I think will be one of the themes for the call today, is, Nathan said, and I think he's quite right, that businesses, private sector, should not subsidize the defense of essentially a public good, the internet, from a foreign adversary. But at the same time, there are proponents out there of either regulation or civil litigation reform that will essentially cause that to happen. And it's tough in the internet space to attribute an attack to a particular actor. So you can't say, hey, nation state attack, we're going to share the cost of this one. Oh, hacker attack, you should have foreseen this. We're not going to share the cost of this one. That one's on you. It is shadier and murkier than that, and I think we need to think about a system that takes that into account.
John, I'll just jump in real quick to give you my two cents. I think there's a lot of overblown language being used in the cybersecurity space, and lots of specters of terrorists and nation states hacking in and taking down the electrical grid or some other catastrophic event. But the DNI and the head of the NSA just testified in the last month or two that those sorts of events are not in the foreseeable future. Although, they're working very hard to make sure that they don't become a reality someday. And it's really a small layer of companies and entities that are going to be targeted by these advanced persistent threats that won't be thwarted by basic hygiene and off-the-shelf cybersecurity products. That will get the average person and most small businesses and people who aren't really holding on to things like intellectual property or military secrets through the cyber threat. But I think this is a dangerous area. For example, you'll hear the phrase cyber attack, and everything is framed as an attack, where in reality, a lot of this is just everyday criminal behavior being conducted over the internet, protest behavior, prank behavior, and rises more to the level of nuisance behavior than really a serious homeland security threat. So I think we need to make sure that we don't go too far and give this more credence than it's worth.
I'd like to ask the other two panelists, what do you guys think of the notion that we do need to kind of make sure we don't go too far, keep it to critical infrastructure providers, and really make sure we're not focusing on, digital graffiti, a lot of people call things like denial of service attacks and protests, and really focus on the high-end threats that Michelle was just mentioning?
Yeah, this is Nathan. I think that's generally right. There's cyber attacks and then there's cyber attacks. In many cases, we can trust market mechanisms to provide the adequate incentives to firms to defend themselves, but in some cases we can't. So if you're an ordinary retailer operating in a competitive market, if you're Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or whatever, you have some market-based reasons to make sure that your system doesn't suffer a denial of service attack or your system isn't breached and turns over customer information such as credit cards to outsiders. Because if you do, your customers are going to flee to your competitors. Now, at the other end of the spectrum where you have critical infrastructure operated by, for instance, monopoly utilities like your power company or your gas company, you don't really have the same sort of market mechanisms there, because if your power company gets taken down, you can't just switch in many cases to some competitor product. So it's interesting that the types of critical infrastructure targets that are most interesting to our determined and skilled adversaries, they also tend to be the ones that don't have a corresponding market incentive to invest in defense, because if you don't, you're not going to lose your customers. And conversely, the relatively competitive markets like online retailing that foreign governments aren't interested in, you do see a market incentive to adequately defend.
Very quickly, it's Gus. I think I agree with Michelle's overarching point, which is we should call things what they are. The attribution problem, which I mentioned before, makes that slightly more difficult in this space. But there's one point that I think was being made that I do disagree with, which is, you know, the sophisticated tools that nation states have developed and are deploying are not just used on, you know, the big attack that that is imagined and that the intel heads testified recently is, you know, not in the foreseeable future. Those tools, as they are defeated and sort of trickle down to from APT-1 to APT-5 to APT-17, are being used on U.S. companies that are not in the defense industrial complex that have interesting information, whether it be IP or code or really anything that can be of advantage in a business relationship to our adversary or people who are supported by the adversary. So we're saying the same thing, but I don't want the impression to be left that the only place where the U.S., the government, should be weighing in to share information about threats is when it's, you know, a big deal, we're going to take down the power grid. The same sophisticated tools are being used by our adversaries on medium to large size companies in the U.S. that you don't associate with, you know, I'm selling planes to DOD.
So would that go, would you categorize them as critical infrastructure providers? I mean, beyond, you know, power companies, but also we're including banks, aviation firms, other transport companies, things like that. Would you still want to limit the scope so it doesn't, you know, grow to everybody, or how does that work?
Well, I think the question has to be framed. It's Gus again. I mean, limit what? If you're limiting regulation, then, you know, it's arguable for the points that I made before that whatever regulatory standard is developed, that it will eventually trickle down and trickle through the entire economy, even if you only directly regulate those entities that are in critical infrastructure, like the ones you mentioned. But if you're limiting information sharing, then it puts the medium to large companies that are not in the critical infrastructure area, so defined, at a terrible disadvantage because they're not learning about the things that they need to defend themselves from the very same threats and tactics that are being used against critical infrastructure.
And I'll just add one last thought here. You know, and for all of these instances, if someone is attacked, regardless who did the attacking or whether they're a large company or a small company, they can report it. They can go to DHS. They can go to the FBI. They could share that information. What's controversial, though, looking forward, is that companies don't want to report on themselves. They want to report on their customers, and that's where a statutory change is needed and is much more controversial. So I think all of the examples we are even using here, that information can already be shared under current law without any further amendments that would affect privacy.
This is what I wanted to jump into next, actually, is from all of you, what is needed to share information? What type of information, how do you facilitate it being shared fast enough to combat cyber threats, but at the same time, you know, how do you address concerns that it may harm civil liberties? It could be misused. Do you narrow the scope of the information that's collected? Do you restrict how it can be used? And at the same time, how do you make sure that people aren't sued for sharing information improperly? And how do you make sure it happens in real time?
Right. This is Gus. So I'll try to be very quick. There are, I think, two very general ways to think about this. One is put the burden on the private sector sharer, or put the burden on the government sharee. And obviously that relationship can be turned upside down when the government is sharing with the private sector, but let's think about the private sector sharing to the government. First principle, this is a voluntary program. No one is proposing, nor do I think they could, that private sector actors be forced to share information with the government. Instead, The goal is to set up a sharing program that allows real-time information to be shared quickly with the government and disseminated so it has some real security impact in the world. If at the same time you're trying to get people to voluntarily share information, you're saying if you do it wrong, either we're going to take a regulatory action against you, that is the government, or someone will have a private cause of action against you, then no one will participate. It's very easy. If instead, and by the way, I think it's fair to say that no one really has an incentive to share more information with the government than is necessary to do what needs to be done. It could happen incidentally or accidentally. It could even happen maliciously, and that's a different subject. But the burden here, if what we want is quick sharing of information, we should ask that the private sector that they cut out personal information to the extent that that's possible, but the government should employ its well-worn minimization rules to whatever it receives under this program and not further, you know, use or disseminate anything that contains personal information. That's where the burden should lie.
This is Nathan. Sorry, Michelle, you go ahead.
Okay, thank you. You know, I would say that we would really want both the scoping on the front end and a good definition of what can be shared. Either way, Congress is drafting a definition of what can be shared for a new program that is voluntary. So it's not that any new burdens will be imposed on companies. It's if they voluntarily choose to participate in this program, they do have to do it in a certain way, or they can be held liable. That's really the only way to prevent oversharing. And if it's like Gus says, there's no incentive to overshare, and besides, you know, accidents, which can be accounted for, there really is no reason not to put that in. And there was testimony before the House Intelligence Committee and the House Homeland Security Committee just in the last few months from representatives from the financial sector and other places that are expected to engage in this activity that they can pull out the personal information, and it is not burdensome. Because when you think about it, this is going to be automated regardless of whether you have privacy protections or not. And that's really the goal. It's not mentioned in the bill, but there's going to be some sort of code written that once triggered, information will be shared directly with DHS or whoever the entity is that's going to be designated for this, or to another company. And so privacy or not, it's going to happen in real time. We're just saying that when you write those rules that are going to be automatically employed without a person having to make a decision on every piece of information, that they minimize out PII where it's not necessary, and that it's not just a hit forward and include all sorts of sensitive data.
So this is Nathan. Let me take a swing at this. Let me take a step back, actually, and look at the big picture here. So when we're talking about information sharing, there's actually a number of different types of information that can be shared, and there's a number of different mechanisms through which it could be shared. So one mechanism is a firm acquires cyber threat or cyber vulnerability information and shares it with the government, and then the government broadcasts it out to other parties that participate in this scheme. Another model is a firm shares information directly with another firm rather than first routing it through a central regulatory storehouse. And then a third mechanism for sharing information is the government has the data and pushes it out to private firms. You think of the partnerships between you know, the NSA and Google, or the NSA and banks, in which Google and banks are receiving otherwise very sensitive and perhaps classified threat signatures from sophisticated foreign adversaries. So on this call, we've talked an awful lot about firm-to-government sharing. I actually want to spend some time thinking about firm-to-firm sharing. This, to my mind at least, is a potentially more valuable type of information sharing than a mechanism that routes it directly through the government for a number of different reasons. I think it can be faster. I think if you route it through the government, you create a Fort Knox problem where a cyber adversary can take all the data that it wants if there's a central storehouse, or interfere with a central storehouse and in a way that wouldn't occur if we have just like a distributed model for distributing information. So is firm-to-firm sharing taking place right now? What are the legal obstacles to it? Well, beyond the legal obstacles, there are a number of financial reasons not to share information with a competitor. You don't want to confess error. We just got hacked. If Pepsi gets hacked, the last person it wants to know about that is Coke, right? So there are a number of reasons like that that the firms don't share information with one another. But there's another legal obstacle to them doing so, and that's antitrust law. Firms are reluctant to interact or coordinate activities with their competitors for fear of incurring antitrust liability along with treble damages. So one type of reform that I'd like to see in the future to facilitate this kind of sharing is for policymakers to think about how to get around that antitrust liability problem, whether it's government-sponsored cybersecurity exchanges that can extend some sort of informal immunity or a statutory carve-out that would extend express antitrust immunity. I'm not really sure what that should look like, but I do think that the antitrust problem is a real problem, and it's interfering with what is potentially an even more significant form of sharing than when a firm turns it over to DHS.
And just for the record, when we talk information sharing, we're usually talking in cyber digital threat signatures, basically ones and zeros is what the government loves to say. That's the line. Is that accurate?
This is Nathan. I think that's a big part of it. Here's the malware to look out for in case you encounter it on your system. There's other kinds of information that I think are also valuable, such as countermeasure information. If infected, do this to disinfect your system. And also vulnerability information. There's a bug in our proprietary SCADA software, so be aware of it and fix it in your own systems.
Okay, so moving on to our final question before we open it up to the audience questions. What should these regulations look like? Should they be an outcome-based set of regulations drafted by industry? I mean, we talk about how the executive order is looking at, is trying to get industry's take on that. I'd love to hear everybody on the panel, your further thoughts on this.
I'll do a lightning round. I think the answer is yes. Your question was, should industry weigh in? Industry definitely should weigh in. For reasons that were already discussed, including that this is likely to cascade through through the private sector as perhaps the standard of care in future cases. Nathan's critique of notice and comment rulemaking is spot on, and there's another tool that is already in the president's toolbox that they're not using here, which is again a DHS authority that allows DHS to adopt standards created by the private sector and accredit private sector agencies to essentially be the certifier. So a private sector agency can go to this other private sector agency and say, please certify that my network is secured in accordance with this standard. This moves a lot of the rulemaking in quotes from NIST or DHS or whatever government agency to the private sector, and I think it injects the nimbleness that that Nathan was quite rightly thinking would not exist in notice and comment rulemaking.
My quick answer will be, it's not clear that any legislation will pass anytime soon in this area. Partly because it's controversial, but partially because Congress is pretty much jammed up with partisanship and things these days that make it hard to get anything done. And so if there's not legislation supporting it, it has to be a voluntary program. There has to be buy-in from the companies who are going to be regulated by it. So I think, they have an eye towards that and they're realistic. The good news is that there are really tight deadlines in that executive order, and some things will start to be promulgated within 6 months. So by the end of the summer, we'll start seeing the outcomes of this process, and it will become more clear about who will be regulated and what the standards will be.
I think this is Nathan. We're short on time, so I'll actually pass on that in the interest of hearing from some of our audience.
Okay, then, Dean, let's go to the audience.
All right, thanks very much. In a moment, we'll all hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you're in the audience, if you have a question for any of our experts, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Stand by. So once again, if you have a question for anyone in our panel, we've got just over 10 minutes left. We've got two questions pending. You need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone to join the queue. Let's go to our first audience member.
Hi, this is Mike Doherty in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm the president and CEO of LabMD and a member of the Federalist Society, one of the few non-lawyer ones. I'm actually currently under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission for an alleged data security breach. So standing back at the big macro level, I am really nervous about the slow lumbering government agencies being able to do anything and something moving so white lightning fast as technology. And that's probably the biggest challenge because I have basically found to be inundated with attorneys without a lot of real technology knowledge trying to enforce poorly written, broadly written regulatory language to push an agenda. And so how realistic, let alone passing legislation, how realistic is this to be actually effective? Did I lose you?
Who wants to take a shot at that question?
Sorry.
This is Michelle. I could do a quick answer.
There's no such thing as a quick answer, but I get it.
Yeah. I mean, it's a good question, and it's a continuing problem, especially with these post 9/11 authorities that expand the government's power in the name of Homeland Security or national security. And, you know, we have very little information about what they've been doing and whether it's been effective, and it stays behind, you know, the cloak of the intelligence community. So it's really hard to tell whether these sorts of programs work. I can say that DHS touts and NSA touts that they have been successful and their information has been useful, but, you know, there's not a lot of detail on, exactly how that's worked out.
Anyone else want to weigh in here?
Yeah, this is Nathan. I share the skepticism, but not to the extent of Michelle's comment. I think there are certain things that the government's good at, military functions, police functions. There's certain things the government is not good at, or at least is not as good at as the private sector is. And I think acquiring the knowledge necessary to oversee cyber is one of those things the government simply doesn't do as well as private sector firms. So I share your concern that any regulatory standards would simply be, you know, setting up a group of self-proclaimed bureaucratic experts to fail. I don't think it has to be that way, though. As Gus has suggested, and as I said previously, you know, it's possible to envision a regulatory model that relies on significant input from the private sector, whether that's the private sector coming up with standards and then having them blessed or certified by DHS or some other model. I think it is possible to have the force of government sanction to give an incentive to comply with the standards, and at the same time have standards that meaningfully correspond to cyber realities because they're based on private sector expertise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very quickly, this is Gus. While I respect Michelle's jumping at the opportunity to go after the post 9/11 authorities that the government got through legislation, I think what the caller said is that problem that he's experiencing is an FTC investigation. Is that right?
I think he must have gone to mute.
Okay, I'm sorry. FTC investigation. So the FTC, you know, investigates deceptive trade practices. So what we have here, I think, is a dissonance between what we know to be happening, and I'm not talking about the particular case, but we know that companies are experiencing sophisticated cyber attacks, sometimes from nation states, sometimes from sophisticated hackers using their tools. And on the one hand, part of the executive branch, as evidenced by the executive order, wants to share information with them and bring up the security standards for all of the ships in the harbor to try to ward off this threat. And on the other hand, an agency with a different mission, like the FTC, who investigates and takes regulatory action against what they perceive to be deceptive trade practices, is doing quite another thing. So it goes to the will this be successful question. It has a chance of being successful if we step back and think about what our national strategy should be in response to this threat.
All right, we've got one more question pending at this point. If you want to ask a question of our experts, you need to push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Yeah, terrific. Hi, everybody. I run the InfraGuard program in New York City. If you don't know what it is, InfraGuard is a public-private program that has been in effect with the FBI for well over a dozen years. So there is a lot of public sector, private sector information exchanging going on. I happen to be in agreement. I think making this some sort of a federal legislative event would only deter a lot of companies to get involved because they don't want to give their information in any manner, shape, or form over to a government entity for fear that they'd be liable or public exposure. The government has set a very, very low standard for their own security posture, and as a result, they have been intruded upon by a number of different entities from around the world. So the InfraGuard program has 86 different alliances around the country and over 50,000 members that are in the cybersecurity arena exchanging information and best practices every single day of the week. I only know that because I've been running it 12 years since I retired from NYPD here in the city of New York. So the structure is there. The exchanges could benefit from fueling InfraGuard a little bit and giving it some funding base. Again, that brings up all sorts of other issues and problems about creating, new lines of industry and things of that nature. But with a little funding, the InfraGuard program and with some national recognition could go a long way to accomplishing what people are trying to make a legislative decree.
It's Gus. I hope somebody who can provide you funding is listening to the call, first of all. Secondly, I think the InfraGuard program, which I am familiar with, is a great example of a partnership that's developed sort of as the result of a threat and a vacuum, and it works. There are ways to make it better, some of which you've detailed, but we thank you for what you're doing.
You're welcome.
Looks like we've got another couple questions. We do have to stop on the hour. Let's see if we can get through these questions. Go to the next caller.
It's just Mike Doherty again. Very briefly, I just need to clarify that I'm not under any deceptive issues. The Federal Trade Commission is going after reasonableness after we sustained an attack, saying that we were not tight enough. Now, that is not the topic of this. The bigger topic, though, is this is what happens when you get the bureaucrats and lawyers without any background in IT making up bad law, whether it's in the FTC or other regulatory bodies. But I felt compelled to come back on saying this is not about deception. Thank you.
All right. Final question.
Hi, this is Hugo Teufel. My question for the panelists is throughout over 40-odd states and other jurisdictions, there are breach notification laws. The ARA within the High Tech Act has a breach notification requirement. And so you've got, throughout the United States, requirements to notify the public if there is a breach of a personally identifiable information. How does that play into the current effort and industry's concerns about information sharing, if at all?
Well, there is no overarching national breach notification law right now, and some people have proposed one, and it just hasn't gotten off the ground in the last few years. It's been even more controversial than some of these other issues, so I don't know if that's got a future ahead of it. But I think the movement is actually in the opposite direction, where companies can report this information to the government and then have the government send it back out and cleanse it so that it could help hide the identity of the company that was breached. And I think actually the efforts we've seen recently have been moving towards, you know, less accountability, less market forces, and more secrecy about these sorts of events.
Hey, I'll jump in quickly. It's Gus. Hugo, it's good to hear your voice. I just want to take the opposite side of what Michelle just said. Well, I think the incentive-based structure needs to be instituted that allows private sector entities to share with the government without the sort of ramifications that we've been talking about. If you look at the front page of the newspaper, the trend is actually the opposite of what Michelle just described. That is, companies are being more proactive and are being quicker to disclose cyber attacks, especially ones that have an effect on their customers, on their goodwill, on someone's account. You look at the Evernote hack, the Living Social hack. It was a week and a half ago. Password file was disclosed, was somehow hacked out of Living Social servers. They forced a password reset on all of their users and said, hey, users, this happened, not because their Living Social account was at risk, but because a lot of people, and this is a hygiene point, use the same password on for everything. So I think the private sector position is not let's hide from what's happening. Instead, it's there are incentives baked in for them to disclose so they don't lose the goodwill of their customers, et cetera. And I think getting back to Hugo's question, the role of these statutes, state-level statutes, as well as the state attorneys general, who are the main enforcement mechanism for the statutes, is actually causing that to happen. So if there is the potential that personally identifiable information was part of what was hacked, though there's no federal cause of action, and I'm not arguing that there should be in any way, companies, other private sector actors have to think about the data breach notification laws that exist. I think it must be 44 or 45 states now. Thanks.
Well, folks, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it right there. We are out of time. But on behalf of the Federalist Society, I do want to thank our panelists today for their time and for their remarks, Mr. Gus Coldabella, Michelle Richardson, Professor Nathan Sales, and John Reed. It's been a pleasure. And to the audience, I urge you to take a look at the website and check for a schedule of our upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until our next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.